Again, happy Mother's Day. So you can see, we're continuing our series in Judges, but we're going to skip ahead a little bit temporarily. As we do, the sermon slide picture there, this was kind of an interesting one. I couldn't find one I wanted, so I went to AI for help. And this is one the computer generated for me. It's a little creepy, I will admit. I asked it to make Samson as a child, and it looks like they made like a grown man just a little smaller. So for those who would ask, that's Samson and his mother standing in a field. But we're going to talk about Samson's mother today. If you were writing a hero's story, if you were going to pen it down, and it's kind of relevant right now because we're in movie season for the summer. Movies are starting to come out again, which I like movies. I enjoy stories. But one of the things that's special about this time of year, if you pay attention, sometimes they're only in the theater for a couple of weeks, but there are, I think, dozens of biopics coming out, or biopics. These are movies that are kind of based on biographies, but again, they're movies, so they have to fit like a whole life story into 2 hours or so. But these stories come out, these movies come out, because they're usually the ones trying to win an award, trying to win an Oscar. So we've got ones about Madonna and Michael Jackson and some of the Beatles, and there are so many that are coming out this summer. But again, and maybe even thinking in that context of how do we tell the story, a life story, a heroic story, how do we tell that in an hour and 45 minutes or 2 hours? Where do we begin? Well, most of these stories, when they begin at some high water moment or just before that high water moment in the life of the person they're covering. Others begin with that crisis that happens just before they make it and become famous. But the reality is, if we were to sit down and write our story of what God is doing, it starts long before. And if we're being 100% honest, when God writes our story, it begins all the way back before the womb. See, for all of us, for any heroic story, and again, remember, all of us are made in God's image. All of us carry that image. So that means that we have tremendous value, tremendous potential. None of us better or worse than the other. We're all created by God to do great and powerful things in partnership with Him. But again, God tells us through the prophet Jeremiah, in Jeremiah chapter 1, verse 5, "Before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. Before you were born, I set you apart. I appointed you as a prophet to the nations." And I understand that promise may have been specifically and individually to Jeremiah, but God promises the same for us, that He knows us before we were conceived. He knows us. And so our story begins long before we realize it. And for Samson, we're going to see that his story begins as a great deliverer, as a great hero to the people of God. His story really begins with his mother. His story begins with a mother who is unnamed, unseen in the scriptures. It begins with a mother who is barren and struggling, but it begins with his mother long before he is ever born. Before his name is ever thought of or spoken, God begins the story of a hero with a mother. And today, as we celebrate Mother's Day, as we honor our mothers, I want us to realize that our stories also begin long before today. And I recognize one of the challenges for pastors on Mother's Day, especially as the size of the room gets bigger, there's always those in the room who didn't have a good relationship with their mother. And that's hard, and we don't love that, but we understand that in God's perfect design, the mother is there to nourish and protect and cultivate and prepare. And many of us had that, but some of us didn't. And if you are in that place, we grieve with you, but we also recognize that God is capable of not only healing the wound, but likely bringing other people into your life, weaving others into your story that helped prepare you, that helped you get where you needed to be, that are still there to come in and prepare you for what's next. Well, maybe we didn't have a spiritual mother, and I'm thankful that I did. If you didn't have an earthly mother to be those things, God is ready to bring others in. I would just ask. There's also a reality that not everybody who wants to be a physical mother gets that opportunity. There are those that really, really want to have children, and they can't. And that's difficult. And for those, we also grieve. But recognize that being a mother isn't just involved with carrying and conceiving and birthing a child. You can be a spiritual mother in the same way Paul, who never had children of his own, became a spiritual father to so many in the birth of the church. God can still use us to make disciples and be spiritual parents. But again, I want to go back to the ideal. Because for a lot of us, we did get to experience earthly mothers that God used to prepare us to do His will and to accomplish His purpose. And behind almost every great leader is a great mother. So we recognize that when God writes the story, it begins before the womb, that He knew us, that He had plans for us before we were conceived. And as we look at Samson's mother, we're going to see how God set her apart to set him apart. Our text is from Judges 13. We're going to go back again. We're going to pick up where we left off, but we're jumping ahead for Mother's Day. In verse 2, a certain man in Zorah named Manoah from the clan of the Danites had a wife who was childless, unable to give birth. The angel of the Lord appeared to her and said, "You are barren and childless, but you are going to become pregnant and give birth to a son. Now see to it that you drink no wine or other fermented drink, and that you do not eat anything unclean. You will become pregnant and have a son whose head is never to be touched by razor, because the boy is to be a Nazarite, dedicated to God from the womb. He will take the lead in delivering Israel from the hands of the Philistines." Then the woman went to her husband and told him, "A man of God came to me. He looked like an angel of God, very awesome. I didn't ask him where he came from, and he didn't tell me his name. But he said to me, 'You will become pregnant and have a son. Now then, drink no wine or other fermented drink, and do not eat anything unclean, because the boy will be a Nazarite of God from the womb until the day of his death.'" Then Manoah prayed to the Lord, "Pardon your servant, Lord. I beg you, let the man of God you sent come to us again to teach us how to bring up the boy who is to be born." God heard Manoah, and the angel of God came again to the woman while she was out in the field. But her husband Manoah was not with her. The woman hurried to tell her husband, "He's here, the man who appeared to me the other day." But Manoah got up and followed his wife. When he came to the man, he said, "Are you the man who talked to my wife?" "I am," he said. So Manoah asked him, "When your words are fulfilled, what is to be the rule that governs the boy's life and work?" The angel of the Lord answered, Your wife must do all that I have told her. She must not eat anything that comes from the grapevine, nor drink any wine or other fermented drink, nor eat anything unclean. She must do everything I have commanded her." So we see an interesting passage here. The first thing I want to draw our attention to is that God sees the unseen. Samson's mother is unnamed. To this day, we have no idea. There is no history book that tells us her name. The scriptures leave out her name. In many of the stories, we have the story of Hannah, and we have the story of Sarah, and we have the story of so many great mothers, and we're given their name. But here, this woman was so unseen in her own time, in her own home, that she's not even named. She's barren, which if you think it's difficult to be barren now, back then being barren was harder. Your whole value in society in this period of time was your ability to create a child. That child was not just your charge to take care of. That was your retirement plan. That was your future. There was no social security check. You needed your child to take care of you. If you didn't have children back in this time, life got hard fast. So she's unnamed, she's barren, she's socially insignificant, just working the field. Her husband doesn't even believe her when the angel of the Lord appears to her. Her husband is like, okay, God, I need to hear it from you. Yet God chooses her to accomplish his purpose. When we read the story of Sarah, we realize that Sarah was already in a special place when God made that promise. They'd already set apart Abraham and Sarah. But here, God takes someone who has not yet been set apart and sets them apart. And I believe for everyone listening this morning, that is incredibly meaningful. I hear day in and day out people say, "Well, why would God use me?" Because he created you in his image, because you are here, because you have a reach and you have a network and you have people around you and opportunities that no one else has. That's why God would choose to use you, to partner with you. We think of ourselves as insignificant. We remember the sin that we've heaped on. And again, it's important to have that forgiven, to confess it before the Lord. But again, God uses the unseen. And we know that many of the roles of a mother are unseen. Now, I'm wired a little funny. So when I come home, I often say the wrong thing. I don't know if any other husbands can relate to this. And it comes from a good place, but I realize that my words don't always mean the same thing in my head that they do for my wife. So when I come home and I'm trying to legitimately just know about her day, I typically would say something like, "What did you do all day?" Now, to Beth's ear, she hears something that I didn't intend. She feels like I'm judging her, that somehow I'm saying, "You didn't do anything all day." And that's not where my heart is. But I understand I need to be more careful with my word choices. But so many of the things that a mother does, they go unseen. It's the season of May, and there's a funny video that I posted on LinkedIn. Beth had showed me a year ago, but it's a parody. And this song, it's a music singing to "It's Going to Be May." And it reminds us that in the month of May, there's constant sports banquets and participation trophies and graduations. We have next week preschool graduation, which again, it's cute. I love it. But I'm not sure it's the greatest accomplishment these kids will have. I'm guarantee there will be bigger things to come. But we graduate from like every grade, it feels now. We need a ceremony for it. And they're fun and they're cute, and I'm not knocking it, but if you were a parent, especially a parent of four, the month of May is exhausting. There are emotions over finals and projects and group projects. There's all of the banquets that are somehow at 9:30 at night on a school night. It just all adds up. But I've never been to an awards banquet for moms, where we give trophies back and say, hey, mom, for that dragging me out of bed at 7 o'clock in the morning the other day when I didn't want to go and I would have failed my test, thank you. For rushing out the door in your bathrobe to give me my bagel before I got on the school bus, thank you. Or sliced up orange. For running out to keep the bus driver from driving away in the bathrobe. Hair a mess. Moms do a lot of things that go unseen. And it's easy for a mom to feel like her role is not significant and not seen. But God, in that very moment, chooses the unseen to do His will, to accomplish His purpose. The angel of the Lord appeared to her and said, you are barren and childless, but you are going to become pregnant and give birth to a son. Now, in the next point, we're going to honor her faith a little bit, and that's great. It's important, but at some point, I think for any of us, if we get good news, I mean really good news, we're not going to question it. We're going to say, you know what? Great, I'll take it. Because for her, this is the winning lottery ticket. God says to her, you're going to become pregnant. I love the fact in the scripture, she says to her husband, he was awesome. He was this bright and shining. I'm assuming he was from the Lord because he brought good news, but I didn't ask his name, and I'm not going to. I'm not going to look too closely. I'm going to squint a little bit because this is news I want to be true. But for some of us, we struggle. God could give us the best possible news. And we're like, okay, God, not me. I'm not worthy. I'm not good enough. You'll never accomplish that through me. That must have been yesterday's bad pizza. That was a sermon that I fell asleep to. Whatever. But God, no, you're not doing that. Samson's mom says, yes, absolutely. Make it so. So God uses the unseen woman. He uses Samson's mother to accomplish his purpose long before Samson is born. The second is that God honors faith and obedience. Samson's mother's response is immediate. She tells her husband what God said and starts obeying immediately. And he's confused. The husband doesn't know what to expect because he knows his wife has been barren. He doesn't throw a celebration party. He says, excuse me, Lord, pardon me, sorry about this, but could you bring that guy back and I'd like to hear it from him because I can't believe the words coming from my wife. And then his question, like to justify the whole thing, is even weirder. He's like, okay, I hear you. Like, what rules are we going to raise him by? Like, how do we do this? Is he going to be vegan? Is he, like, what are we supposed to do here? And part of it's because the directions that were given to his mother, the directions that she repeats, it's clearly important because it's repeated about three times in this passage what it is that she is supposed to do, that Nazirite vow. And we're going to get into that in a moment. But God honors faith and obedience. And it's not blind faith. She saw the man. He appeared to her. So it's not like this just popped into her head. God gave a sign. He doesn't always give us the benefit of a sign. But we have to understand that faith and obedience, it's not what the world says. I mean, I think the world tries to paint this picture that if we are to be faithful or have faith and obedience, that means it's blind faith and obedience, that it's an irrational thing to do. That's not true. She lived in a nation of the people of God who, again, the passage begins in verse 1 by telling us what almost every passage in the Judges do. In Judges 13, verse 1, we see again the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord. So the Lord delivered them into the hands of the Philistines for 40 years. So 40 years have gone by, and the people of God have been oppressed. They are all likely quite poor. And many had forgotten the old ways. They'd forgotten the promises. But as long as 40 years is, it's not as long as some of the other periods that we see. It's not hundreds of years. But she chooses to believe. And she does it because she's part of the people of God, and there's a history and tradition of what God has done. She does it because she has a sign. The angel of the Lord appears to her and tells her this is going to happen. But we too need to exercise our faith. The book of Judges is filled with people that ask for another sign and yet another sign. When we get to Gideon, we'll talk about his fleece. God tells him what to do, and he's like, okay, God, just to be sure, I'm going to put a fleece outside, and if it's dry, it means one thing. If it's wet, it means another. And he has to keep asking, keep being reminded. Last week, we talked about Barak, who is given the message that he would be this great general and defeat the army by the prophetess, but yet he chooses to say, Deborah, only if you come with me. And so God is using imperfect people, and we are imperfect people, but there is power in immediate obedience. And don't let the world convince you that all faith is blind faith. I heard a comedian the other day. He said, it's funny to me how one group of people in this country makes fun of another group of people's faith. And he looks at the creation story. And he said, the Christians believe that this powerful, almost unnameable force that we call God, but again, unnameable in the fact that like Yahweh wasn't even supposed to be spoken in the Jewish tradition in the early days. It's missing vowels, so in Hebrew you can't even say it. But this power of the universe creates us. And then when we die, we go back to that. And he said, so the atheists, what do you believe? And he said, we believe that nothing created everything. And that is what the Big Bang Theory is nothing created everything. And that's a hard thing. There's a leap of faith there too, isn't there? You go to Richard Dawkins and some of these others, they have such a difficulty trying to say that nothing created everything because that's foolishness. That they now say, well, maybe aliens did it. And again, you can say that it's foolish for me to have faith in God when there's an archaeological record and we have these scriptures that have been handed down and maybe we've had personal spiritual experiences as well. But you can't tell me that in any math, it's more irrational to believe in God than it is to believe in aliens or to put all your faith into nothing. So you ask the atheist, what happens when you die? Well, simple, you go back to nothing. You rejoin it. And so, okay, well, your creator is nothing, and then when you die, you go back and join your creator, nothing. Sounds a whole lot like God to me, just with a different name. So faith, the world is going to tell you that your faith is blind, that it's foolish. But here we see a woman who God honors because she exercises that faith. And she does it immediately. She doesn't wait. And God can still bless you. God will still use you if you trip and fall along the way. But there is power in immediate obedience. If you raise your hand and say, God, I will go where you send me, you will have blessing for it. First of all, God will spare you from some of the pain that comes with running the other way. Not trying to judge Jonah, but Jonah preached to Nineveh. He had to do it in the belly of a whale for a while first. He had to take that uncomfortable journey, but ultimately he got where God was sending him. If I were Jonah, maybe that was instrumental inside the belly of the whale, but I would have preferred to just go to Nineveh. to just take the trip, to do the thing, and God calls us and he rewards obedience. And that's what we see. Then the woman went to her husband and told him, "A man of God came to me. He looked like an angel of God, very awesome." And we use that word a little too loosely these days. Very awesome. Awe-inspiring. I didn't ask him where he came from, and he didn't tell me his name. It wasn't even important because I realized this was God at work. She didn't need more proof. She didn't need more evidence. She just chose to obey. And as we're going to see in a moment, that obedience wasn't necessarily easy. God sets her apart and entrusts her, God sets her apart and entrusts her with a calling that affects generations. Samson would be a Nazarite, set apart to God from birth, but it all starts with his mother's consecration. So we see this is repeated multiple times, but verse 14 is one example. She must not eat anything that comes from the grapevine, nor drink any wine or other fermented drink, nor eat anything unclean. She must do everything I have commanded her. So a little confusion and a little background. Many of you will say, Nazarite, I've heard a word that sounds a lot like that before. What word do we know from the story of Jesus that sounds like Nazarite? Anybody? Nazareth. Well, they sound alike, but they have nothing in common. So it's not, there's no connection there. But the word Nazarite literally comes from the Hebrew word for consecrate. And it comes to us out of the book of Numbers. It was part of the early Mosaic law that was given that all of God's people were image bearers and were set aside to be God's people. But there was another tier that could voluntarily happen where you could take a Nazarite vow. And it was a vow of consecration, and it was a way in which God's people could live in another level of separation to God, and separation from the world, but separated to God. And the vow had a few different rules. One of them is they couldn't cut their hair. This was more of an outward symbolic approach to let everybody know. If you were a man of God and your hair was really long, then don't offer that man a drink. Okay, it was a way for them to know, okay, this was a Nazarite. It wasn't for them to brag about it. It wasn't for them to hold it over others, but it was an outward symbol of what was happening. The other things is they weren't allowed to drink anything that was fermented. And that sounds easy because a lot of us in our churches have kind of lived that way or grown up that way anyways. But this is a day and age where clean water wasn't really much of an option. And the way that you could sanitize it was you'd ferment it. Oftentimes, the safest thing to drink was a little bit of wine. And it wasn't like the aged wines that we have today that were like crazy high alcohol proofs. But it was enough alcohol that it made it safe to drink. There were no refrigerators in the first century or the centuries later. And actually, here we're going way back before the first century. We're in the BCE era. But no refrigeration. And we're out in the desert. So if you have grape juice and you're keeping it in a jar, it's fermenting. Remember when I was a kid, I won a Boy Scouts, I sold enough, Cub Scouts, popcorn, and I got a canteen. And it was a metal canteen that went in this kind of nylon sack that you would carry around your neck. I was pretty excited about it. And at the time, I enjoyed drinking apple juice. So I didn't put water in my canteen, I put apple juice in my canteen. And I wasn't very old. This isn't Boy Scouts. This was Cub Scouts, just so my intelligence isn't too heavily challenged here. But I went out, and in the backyard across from the little creek, we had this little clubhouse that didn't belong to us. It belonged to the neighbors, but it was gross and abandoned, and occasionally you had to wrestle the possum to use it. But it was back there, and I accidentally left my canteen in July in the little clubhouse. And I left it there, and I remembered it days later. I went back out there, and I was like, oh, it's cool. It's my canteen. It had been baking in this hot canteen for days, and I didn't think anything of it. I'm like, I'm going to take a swig of that canteen. And it was pretty much booze. It had fermented at least a little bit. It was pretty gross. So, again, the idea of not drinking anything fermented wasn't just don't go to the liquor store, don't have a glass of wine. It was pretty restrictive. And it's not only anything fermented, but nothing that came from the grapevine. And this is a symbol of luxury. Back then, there weren't very many sweet things. There wasn't refined sugar like we have today. You couldn't go buy a Snickers or a pack of Skittles or whatever your jam is on the candy side. There was no ice cream. So grapes were one of the sweeteners they had. No grapes, no raisins, none of that. And then you couldn't touch or eat anything that was considered unclean. The idea here, again, is these are physical things that are reminders for this person that they have been set apart, consecrated to God for higher, a special purpose. And this tracks for us, I think, too. God has told us that we are consecrated, that we have been made for a special purpose. And if we really start to understand that, if that imagery falls in for us, it changes the way we behave. Beth has, and I guess I do too, as part of our wedding registry. Some of you may have even purchased a place setting or so. But we got married, we have what, like 100 place settings of china? It's a lot, like 12. Okay. It felt like a lot at the time. So we have all of this china. But the china is beautiful. It's gorgeous. But it has some rules. Like you can't dishwash the china. And so when it's family pizza night, we don't pull the china out. Because we don't want to chip the china, we don't want to scratch the china, and we definitely don't want to do dishes. So we eat pizza on paper plates. I'm sorry, we pollute a little bit. But when God makes us set apart and consecrated like that fine china, it helps us understand that we weren't made for the sinful things of this world. When we understand that we have been set apart, that we have a higher purpose, it helps us to abstain from those things that would destroy our soul, that would pollute our purpose, that would ruin our testimony and our witness. And as we're going to see later in weeks to come in Samson's story, God keeps that vow for Samson better than Samson keeps that vow for himself. He struggles with it. But the whole idea of the Nazarite vow is a physical thing that reminds us of the spiritual thing that God has done. There's another famous character in the Bible that we know of in the life of Jesus who was a Nazarite, who had taken that vow. And it's John the Baptist. That's why John the Baptist was this wild man that ate locusts and again, honey, not from the grapevine, so he could do that. But everybody thought John the Baptist was kind of nuts. It was because he had taken this rare and unusual vow. And here, God is setting apart Samson, but he does it by first setting apart his mother. For us, as we read that as a mother, she's told, don't drink wine or fermented things, we're like, yeah, that tracks. If any of us saw a pregnant mother carrying a beer or a glass of wine in their hand, we'd all kind of freak out. But back then, they didn't even know they were pregnant, first of all, until kind of a while in. There was no pregnancy test to grab at the drugstore. But they didn't know. There was no Surgeon General warning that said, don't drink the wine. And often, it was probably a much lower alcohol content anyways, and safer than polluted water. But God has not just made Samson a Nazarite. He was a Nazarite from the moment of his conception. God set apart Samson by first setting apart his mother so that she knew, while she had once been that unnamed, barren, unseen woman, that now she was set apart unto God for a special purpose. And she would carry the deliverer of her generation. But it wasn't just a promise. She had a role. She had a responsibility
to set herself apart as God sets her apart to his purpose.
She must not eat, not just him. This is how she would raise her son. But she herself must not eat anything that comes from the grapevine, nor drink any wine or other fermented drink, or eat anything unclean. She must do everything that God has commanded. And in doing so, the physical, again, is a symbol of the spiritual. I have no doubt, we don't get a whole long passage on it, but if God was doing this in her, I have no doubt that God was using her to tell Samson the stories that so many of the generation had forgotten, to dust off the scrolls, to pull back from memory, to go to the temple, because they were set apart by God. Now, I don't know about you, but one of the biggest blessings that I had as a child growing up, was that my mother took me aside and helped me understand that I had been created in God's image, set apart for a special reason, that God had a calling on my life. Didn't tell me it was for ministry. In fact, they pushed back a little bit, as a parent really should, when a child says, I think I'm called to be a pastor. That's not the easiest road to walk down. I'm glad I have a couple other skills to help pay the bills. My mom, as a very young age, set me aside and we went through Luther's small catechism. We went through the scriptures. I heard the stories of faith, and it wasn't just my mother. It was my father. It was my grandmother. But it was my mother who helped me to know from a young age that I was set apart. If you are a mother, a grandmother, an aunt, if you have any place in the life of someone who's growing, I don't care if they're 4 years old or 40 years old or older, we can help show them that they are set apart for God's purpose. So my question for us to take away this morning is, how was God preparing your story before it began? It's easy to start with the moment of our biggest victory or the moments of our greatest failure, but I want you to go back. I want you to say, God, show me how you were preparing my story before it even began. Where were you working? What were you doing? And I have a strong feeling for many of you, your mother is going to be a part of that. Long before you accepted Jesus, I bet somebody was praying for you. Somebody was saying, Lord, get a hold of that boy. Somebody was praying. Somebody was at work. And this morning, if that was your mother, if your story began with the prayers of your mother, then I would implore you and encourage you to honor your mother today. To pick up the phone, stop by the gravesite, whatever it may be, to say thank you. Thank you, God, for putting them in my life. And thank you, Mom, for being obedient, for consecrating yourself and then consecrating me, for setting yourself apart unto God and helping me set myself apart. One of the ways that you can do that, on each of the tables, there is a rose. And the rose has a little note on it. If you are a mother or a spiritual mother here, we encourage you to take one. But if there are extras, and it looks like there likely will be, especially at my table because there's no mother sitting there, grab one and take it to your mother or another woman or someone who has invested in setting you apart under the mission of God. But I don't care. It doesn't matter if you are unseen today. I do care if you're unseen today. But if you are unseen today, God has a plan, and he's been preparing that plan for a long time to use you to accomplish his purpose.